Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis with Robin Pierce, Jenny Bill, Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Alex Lefchook, and some key additional guests from the Temporal Nexus.
Aren't you one of those key additional guests?
No, I'm the Temporal Nexus.
Gimbal Lock, Skylab as an orbital island, and the USS Kitty Hawk. We have main chutes in sight, and we can be better than before. Better, fitter, faster, and stronger. It's another Resonance Rewind.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
So if I was actually asked to choose my Fido, my flight instruction officer, clearly, as a wingman, I'd go for Robin Pierce. How are you, Robin? Welcome to the rescue of Athena 1. Would you like to do the precy so that the Resonance Rewind team can get their metaphorical and metaphysical thoughts into it?
I have always considered myself, Alex, to be Mr. Spock to your Captain Kirk, which is an odd thing, really, when you consider that this episode, The $6 Million Man, was actually written by one of Star Trek's premier writers, Dorothy D.C. Fontana. And boy, does it show. It's not your typical episode, as we will find out. Those listeners who don't know, The $6 Million Man was a huge series in the 1970s based on the adventures of Steve Austin, an ex-astronaut who had been almost killed in a devastating crash, had both legs, an arm, and his eye replaced by robotic implants. In this episode, he has been assigned to train America's first female astronaut, Major Kelly Wood, who was played actually by Farrah Fawcett Majors, his wife at that time. And it was very much a big deal. It was Hollywood's big power couple of TV. On her maiden flight, a sudden explosion damages the Athena 1 spacecraft and injures Kelly's co-pilot. Now, Austin leads the rescue team and follows her up to Skylab, which is a precursor to the International Space Station that we had back in the 70s, only to find that working out in space, radiation affects his bionic replacements and they start to malfunction. Whatever will we do?
And no spoilers, clearly, in terms of the message that comes across the space. It really is the final frontier. And I can't go, as Steve, of course, says. This certainly takes us back to the time where the romanticism of the spaceflight journey was very much to the fore. We hear this universe that was set up within, obviously, Apollo 17 and Steve Austin being the astronaut who, in our fictional universe at least, was part of the last man to be on the planet, or on the moon, I should say, not the planet. It's obviously not, it's a satellite, it's not a planet. And of course, you had Skylab. You have, of course, 10 years after the Russians first put up Valentina Tereshkova as the first woman in space, the first American woman in space being talked about from that point of view. And, of course, you have that interrelationship between the main characters that are all connected within that, as indeed Oscar Goldman, of course, played by Richard Anderson, says when he says it's taking a long time, the response is, Mr. Goldman, in this business, anything good takes a long time. Jenny, this was one episode where we didn't actually see the slow motion running, for which the $6 million man was probably renowned for. Probably slow motion came into play in television with the David Carradine Kung Fu series a couple of years before Harve Bennett effectively developed $6 million man. And Harve Bennett, of course, would have his own input into the Star Trek motion picture series. But what did you make of Rescue of Athena 1?
This one had fake slow walking, didn't it? Which I didn't really think came off.
It was meant to simulate weightlessness, I believe.
It was meant to simulate weightlessness. It was kind of, yeah, okay. Obviously, I've seen $6 Million Man before. I don't think this is the best episode, but for me personally, because when I was a child, I was totally obsessed from Apollo 8 onwards with the moon missions. I used to stay up at night to watch them. So all the footage was kind of like, oh, it's bringing it all back to me. So from that aspect, I really enjoyed it. How Farrah Fawcett ever became an actress, because she cannot act to save her life. She looks like a Barbie doll, and the Barbie doll would be able to act much better than she ever will be able to in her entire life. I thought she ruined it because she was so rubbish. But it was enjoyable.
Well, harsh words there for somebody who can't really defend herself, and indeed many of the folk who came with us have sadly passed on. Lee Majors, of course, not only famous in the wonderful series The Big Valley as Heath Barkley, he'd also be Colt Seavers and indeed become the voice of Jeff Tracy in the Thunderbirds remake, and thankfully is still with us. Jessica Burtis, let's turn to your good self, our very own answer to Farrah Fawcett Majors or Kelly Woods, in the event of obviously working through the process. As you said, your parents had followed $6 Million Man. What did you make of this early venture into space for the episode and the series?
I think this was the first episode I've watched fully, so it was nice actually getting to watch it from beginning to end. And I actually watched it with both my parents. So, and I like that Jenny mentioned watching, you know, the spacecrafts, because I was asking my parents all about their memories of it. So I had fun with the episode. I thought that it was a chance to kind of see the $6 million man, not quite so, I guess, like Superman-like. He didn't have like the like super strength and like jumping like he seems to in a lot of other clips. So it was kind of a toned down episode, got to see his character, and Farrah Fawcett's hair was somehow always blowing out and looking perfect somehow. So I thought it was a pretty fun episode.
She was the 1970s answer to Alexandra Bastida in The Champions, clearly. It's very important that you folk will work through that system. And indeed, she made several appearances in different characters within the $6 Million Man before, of course, her star very much accelerated on the basis of a poster, which apparently was extremely popular with male college undergraduate students and effectively sort of tipped her into superstardom, after which, of course, roles in Logan's Run, the movie, and, of course, Charlie's Angels, which she was in the first season as Jill Monroe, or was it Kelly Garrett? I think it was Jill Monroe. Maybe it was Kelly Garrett. Anyway, one of those two. It certainly wasn't Sabrina. Anyway, interesting sort of lines from that. I would also recommend, if people are interested, getting hold of the novelization of this particular thing, which conflates both this episode and the season two episode Straight On Till Morning, also written by DC Fontana, and that does give a wonderful fleshing out. But we're not here to do a literary critique. Let's start going into what I feel will be the dark side in terms of all sorts of things. I mean, she is the curmudgeonly soul that actually is Eloise. That's why she rarely switches the camera on, because if she switches the camera on, the curse strikes and we can't hear a thing. So hopefully she'll unmute herself. And Eloise, I don't think you're particularly impressed with respect to the rescue of Athena 1.
I'm going to try and be nice. Don't ever say that I don't try. But yeah, no, it's the first episode I've ever seen of this TV series. I've heard about it before, but I just spent the entire hour judging it, I'm not going to lie. I like the aesthetic of the sort of original spacecraft and all that idea along with sci-fi. But the fact that he got upset that his eyes weren't working, he's just lucky he don't have my eyesight, because he really would have cried then. He just needed to get a little bit of a grip, I feel.
This is the dangerous business we're in. Despite nearly 15 years' experience in space, man is still an alien there. Our ships are far from perfect. They are safe if handled properly and if no accidents occur. We all know that, and we live with it every day, every time one of us goes up. The slightly expanded speech that, of course, Steve Austin gives in his character on the Real Life chat show host that we actually see there, in which, again, another variation on Major Kellywood's hairstyle there, the serious hairstyle that's actually connected, that also begins to see a thawing of their relationship and a kind of reduction in terms of where things were going. Although it has to be said that the somewhat clumsy way in which an arc light actually falls down and nearly actually completely totals somebody without Steve's bionic prowess was perhaps not the best sort of signifier that here we have an American pilot who really actually knows her onions, so to speak, in terms of safety and various other things. Either that or the TV studio itself was a major hazard, and that's a big problem for it, for its own side of things there. But still, Steve could obviously open the door for her anytime. Tessa, you're listening to this as somebody who basically has not had the chance to actually connect with the episode. How is it sounding to you? I mean, we're kind of looking at a number of sort of key things. We went with this because I felt we could go with the Arthur Weingarten episode, but I feel let's go for early on in the sort of sequence and begin to unpick that. What are your kind of feelings at the moment? Are you more a case of, well, I'm going to avoid that like the plague? Or is it a case of, well, if Jessica found it interesting, I should actually go with her? Are you team, you know, bright side Jessica, or are you going down the line of the sort of the film graduate?
Well, you know, I don't like to pick sides, and it is very mixed comments amongst the team, but I love anything space themed anyway. It interests me. So I would definitely give it a go. I think even just from the picture behind you, Alex, I know you've kind of got a screen going there. I kind of get what Jenny was saying, I guess, about the lady there, the female, the star. But I think after watching several episodes of all different kind of series, you know, that we've looked at throughout these episodes, I think there is like a running theme. All the girls are very done up. They are, you know, that they're one type. And maybe that's where the stereotype comes from. That's what I'm finding with all of these. But in terms of the actual, what this is about and what it sounds like it is about, it sounds very, very interesting. And I guess it's, you know, it's from that era, and that's the take that they give on on all of that. So far, yes, I would give it a go. But we'll see what everybody has to say, you know.
I certainly felt there was a sense of jeopardy, which actually repeated viewings doesn't actually take away from. And there is the notion that a wonderful, it's directed by the late Lawrence Doheny. And again, it's lovely to actually start off with an image of the moon, and the whole episode closes with an image of the moon. And I think that's very effective. It's also nice that the music, which of course is written by Oliver Nelson, tragically taken from us by a heart attack at the age of 43, literally a few years after he wrote this particular episode, also kind of echoes the notion of the silence. You know, they don't actually over-egg the pudding. If you've seen Ron Howard's Apollo 13, you can see probably the size and the scale of the motion picture that obviously the Apollo 13 mission actually went through. We don't really get that in here. We do get a kind of almost a plug and play system with respect to mission control. At least they did address something which I felt was initially going to be a flaw, which is how could they actually get a rescue rocket up literally within hours? Because, of course, these things aren't necessarily chump change, unless, of course, you're in Wales and the Robin Pierce household, in which, you know, you can obviously have drones and you can easily set up a sort of rocket ship to rescue things if that was required, Robin. Anyway, you've heard some of the sort of initial side of things. How about yourself, Robin? I mean, were you a $6 Million Man fan? Was it a case of Thursday evenings, it's either Top of the Pops or $6 Million Man? This has got to be it. It's none of this Man from U.N.C.L.E. stuff from the 60s. It's the $6 Million Man on independent television.
Oh, my goodness. In the 70s, in the mid-70s, when I was in my mid-teens, my adolescence, I was beginning to take science fiction very, very seriously. And sci-fi for me was the repeats of Star Trek and the $6 Million Man on its first run. And I hadn't actually seen this episode for several years, and I watched it with my son Steve last night, and our takes on it were a little bit different, because he came away thinking, you know, I guess you had to be there at the time to really get it, and I can see what he means. It's not a typical episode by any means, because this comes fresh off a Apollo 13, which had only happened a few years earlier. And that was still fresh in our minds that things can go terribly wrong up there. Because I remember, sitting there with bated breath when the astronauts were attempting re-entry and we didn't know whether they would burn up or not. So that was it was very topical at the time. And the extensive use of footage from NASA themselves, because there was no special effects budget for spacecraft, kind of added to the authenticity. It's a slow burn episode. It's not the best. I will stress that. It is not. If I was going to show you a typical $6 million man episode, this wouldn't be the one. But it's very, very interesting in that it takes a very humanistic approach, because Austin has his, if you like, superpowers taken away from him because his robot arm, his robot legs and his robot eye won't work. And he has to become the man rather than the $6 million man, which was the cost of his various robot parts. And of course, As we know from Star Trek, DC Fontana was a very humanistic writer. And this is, rather than a triumph of a superhero or a half-man, half-robot over all adversity, it celebrates more, I guess, the human spirit and the human will to survive. They neatly got out of a nasty situation that I thought they were going to put themselves in on the TV talk show, where I thought there was a bit of misogynism coming in when they said, women in space kind of thing. And I was afraid that it might be, Steve Austin going to save the little lady in space because he was a man who can. And of course, in the end, he is completely useless. He can't even hold the joystick or work the controls because his arm will shake. And it's down to her. And I thought it was a very, very potent message. And the other potent thing that I thought was done very, very subtly was at the end, he is actually using a cane, not crutches or anything that dramatic, but he's actually got a wooden cane to walk. And, it's like, you take Superman's powers away and he's just man. And this did that very, very well. But it's not what I would have chosen to introduce people to the $6 million man, because they're not getting the full benefit of it. But those of us who know the series as kind of stepping back and thinking, wow, that's really interesting, unusual, and so well done.
Mm. And of course, the series is just beginning to find its feet here. It actually had four pilots, feature-length pilots produced. As we said, Harve Bennett was given the reins of adapting the Martin Kadin original Cyborg. This is long before people kind of began to appreciate what cyborgs were. You might have actually appreciated the Cybermen in Doctor Who. Then after that, you had Deathlok the Demolisher, Marvel Comics creation. But it was a long time before, obviously, the Terminator and other sort of aspects, and indeed the cyborg character Victor Stone kind of manifested themselves. Jessica, from your own line and what Robin's been saying there, did you feel that also carried with it a strong message beyond me, Colonel, you, Major, a clear riff on the me, Tarzan, you, Jane moment in terms of he's just decided that he's going out and about, even though, of course, he's confessed sort of to a Nurse Kelly that he's actually not fit to do so. As she says, I'm still a nurse. I might be able to tell you something you don't know. Well, yeah, hello,
Yeah, I do think that it was interesting seeing a woman being kind of there in the spacecraft in an early 70s show or early to mid 70s. I think in a lot of shows that we've watched, the women have had, a major role in the show, but they haven't always had their own agency. And so it was interesting seeing the focus being on her in this episode and how he was useless, kind of. Like, he couldn't really rely on those cyborg aspects that, make him the title character. And I thought that was very interesting to see just, how the whole show is him being a human with technology. But then in the end, like, they're having to kind of rely on human ingenuity while they're in like this super state-of-the-art technological advancement. And I thought that was pretty cool. It's very interesting seeing how they brought technology to the show in a completely different way. So I thought that was very interesting.
I flew this thing the way my teacher taught me. Interesting in terms of the way forward within that. Of course, we do get a situation whereby Farrah Fawcett Majors is one of only three women that we see in the role, and the others, Tony Janotta, plays the second secretary, and Patsy Sublime, interesting name, also plays the first secretary. So I suppose no major changes there in terms of the role that's in that. Although you could actually argue that Dean Smith, who played Major Osterman, not Austin, but Osterman, actually says nothing at all and simply gets injured and spends the rest of his time flat on his back and unconscious. So, you know, on that basis, it's maybe a sort of balance there. Eloise, any further thoughts you'd like to share with us at present?
Researching the show online, I wondered if you could give me some insight of why the internet is not quite sure whether the episode is episode 8 or 14, because it was confusing me quite a lot.
One it's would be eight. The production rota, and the other one would be the broadcast. Mm. They're not necessarily broadcast in the order that they were made. Filmed and produced. Yeah.
Like The Prisoner. Unless,
of course, it has continuity, which this doesn't.
Yeah, I think I was watching the wrong episode for a good, like, halfway through, and then we had some people karate moves in the snow, and I was like, this doesn't seem right. I think I need to recheck this.
Sounds as though Karate Moves in the Snow is Dr. Wells is Missing, which is also around in the same season one episode. But, you know, we can't have
one.
Can't have too many goody things. It's nice to have you back, Eloise. That's the important thing. Tessa. Anything you'd like to add? I mean, again, as somebody who hasn't seen this particular thing as yet, do you feel as though you're gravitating more to, well, yes, it's worthwhile, or is it a case of, no, if you want me to watch the Wild Wild West episode from next week, then, you know, I don't have time. I've got canines to look after.
That is very true. But no, as I said, I will give it a go. But I'm interested to know, Robin, what episode would you recommend out of this series for me to watch? Because I know you said you wouldn't necessarily pick this specific
the
one.
First pilot film, the first one, which introduces the character, shows you the accident, and it takes you through the whole process of how he became the $6 million man. That would be my essential starting point. It is, I believe, a very loose reworking of the original novel called Cyborg by Martin Caden. But of course, you know, it's formalized for 1970s Universal TV.
Right, okay. Maybe I should give the two a go and see the differences.
Congratulations, Athena. You're the first victim of Gimbal Lock. Let's talk characters, Jessica. I mean, there are a number. Oscar Goldman, we haven't mentioned, played, of course, by the late Richard Anderson, the avuncular head of the OSI, the Office of Special Investigations. This is clearly a case of organisations working together explicitly, NASA and the OSI, for the benefit of, as we find out, putting up a rocket to actually seek out new sources of fuel. Presumably, they're on orbit around the world. Not sure what the Soviet Union might have thought about that, but what the heck. So who kind of floated your boat? Or was it a case of the doctor and his sort of import? Or were there other sort of flight members who were kind of, if you thought, actually, I quite like flight director John S. Reagan and indeed Capcom, played by Quinn K. Redeker?
I think the main character, is his name Steve? Is that his name? Okay, yeah. I think he's
just like the pro wrestler.
Okay, there we go. Or I was thinking Captain America is he is my favorite character, I think. And we didn't get to meet a ton. I think I just got like Barbie vibes from Farrah Fawcett in this episode, which is completely fine. Love a pink astronaut jumpsuit thing she had at the end. But I think that he was my favorite character. My parents were saying that he's their favorite, you know, he's just like that all-American like 70s hero that was always in the TV shows, and I think that he just seems He seems nice. Like, he just seems like a nice guy. He's very humble, even though he has, like, superpowers. So I think him.
Although, fundamentally, would you actually sort of want to get up in an astro with him if he's actually got somebody who effectively can't actually function on that sort of system? But you're quite right. Certainly, Steve, very popular, because you mentioned Steve Rogers, of course. There was Steve McGarrett, Hawaii 5-0, Steve Burton from Land of the Giant, James, the other very popular first name, Christian name, that's often frequently used, as in James Bond, James West, James Kirk, and so on. It seems as though Steve and James were the go-to words for that kind of solidarity and line with in the whole field. What about yourself, Robin? Are you sticking with Lee Majors as Steve Austin, a man barely alive?
Well, I thought he was a very likable, kind of one-size-fits-all hero of the 70s. He wasn't really that distinguishable. I liked him more as an actor, Lee Majors, in The Fall Guy. But in this episode, and I'm going to go against everybody else's grain here, and I thought that Farrah Fawcett Majors did a pretty good job, bearing in mind it was the 1970s and women were sadly just there for window dressing, hence her hair didn't even float about in zero gravity. But I think she played quite a strong character, and that character actually went on a journey. I mean, there was plenty of time in you know, the following years for Farrah Fawcett Majors to fully embrace the sort of 70s bimbo aspects of network TV in Charlie's Angels. But in here, I thought she did quite a good job. And of course, it was a studio publicist's dream to have both these actors, who were the Brad and Angelina of 70s TV, on the same show.
Even publicists. But there we are. It's absolutely.
Yeah, I was true. Having trouble with that word. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, we identify these things, and again, it did work on that system. Certainly, I feel that, again, if you're looking at other episodes as well as the pilot, I think that the series as well found its feet, certainly with the end of the second season and the introduction of Lindsay Wagner as the Bionic Woman, something else we would actually consider. It lost it sometimes, actually, for me, when Lee Majors grew a moustache. I felt there were certain episodes there that actually became a little bit trivial. And the episodes, so Tessa, if you're looking for that other sort of thing, try and avoid episodes in which Lee Majors has a moustache, okay? It's just a sort of minor point.
Season 4.
But there we are. And indeed, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the $6 Million Man, there's a wonderful comic book graphic narrative series which suggests some routes for season 6 that might have been taken. Okay, Jenny, favourite characters? Are you sticking with Steve Austin, or are you going to go down the line of Oscar Goldman?
No, actually, I will say I really thought that the control room, the NASA control room, was really well done. And I think that the acting and the way they behaved was very, very similar to when you used to see it, really. My favourite, and unfortunately, I don't know what his name was. He's the guy that was kind of in charge in the control room with the sort of big hair that was a bit grey.
That I think would be the flight director, John S. Reagan, who I think is being flagged up from that side of things. Yeah, exactly. Yes,
Farrah Fawcett Majors, she looked amazing. She did play a strong female character. I just really think she's a terrible actress. I'm sorry, but she just spoiled it because I felt her acting was so bad. So I just want to clarify that I do think she played the character was very strong. And yes, she does look amazing, very typical for women of that era. But I just personally, I mean, I knew who she was, and I've seen her in lots of things, and I just thought she was particularly bad in this. Sorry, Farrah.
Well, just as well, Lee Majors isn't joining us. That's all I can say. Eloise, what about your own personal favourites from this? Or is it a case of you can't find one?
You know me so well. Without being completely rude about it, they all sort of blended into the background for me. I spent more of the time being impressed by the production aspects and the set design. Like, the spaceship itself was like really impressive and detailed. So I spent more time actually focusing on the hard work that was being done rather than the really appalling acting and slow moving they didn't match at all. So I started blocking them out about halfway through.
Yes. Okay. Again, I think we agree to differ with respect to that until such time as one produces one's own sort of level of that sort of things. But anyway, okay, let's try and quantify this. Jessica, what's your score?
I think for my parents, especially, their nostalgia made it really fun. So I'd say an 8. I had fun with it. I know that they said the first episode is like the one to watch, and Robin agrees. So I would say I'll have to watch that one and then come back to it. But an 8, I think an 8.
Yeah, I'll go with that. I might even go 8.5. Robin, what about yourself?
Well, my drawback in this, and oh, come on, I always have a drawback, right? They salvaged everything that they could out of the damaged spacecraft, the Athena 1, and the shots of the outside of that were actually of Apollo 13. But I couldn't figure out for the life of me why they would do that, because it was going to be hazardous enough to bring the craft down through re-entry anyway. And these were common terms to us in the 70s. Why make it even worse by overloading the craft? I didn't get that at all. I will go on this one for a 6. Yeah, not the best, not the worst.
Didn't they actually try and actually clear out most of the actual unnecessary stuff so they could fit all
did it go the other way?
Bodies in there? Oh, yes.
I thought they were putting stuff from Athena into the one that was coming back. Oh,
no, no.
Okay, then it gets a 7.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fair points. That's the reason they're actually...
I apologise. I just got that one wrong.
It's true. Again, I think, you know, it does sort of revisiting it does actually help. So, Eloise, what's your score?
Coming into the show, I think I've come in at the wrong episode. If I'd have seen others, I'd probably have appreciated this one more. But other than the things I didn't like, I did really like the set and the production and the idea. So I'll give it a 7.
Ooh. And Jenny?
Well, I think it's a good episode, and I do like the fact that they went out and did something a little bit
just
different.
Just Farrah, if he doesn't do it for you, clearly, is a big problem.
So I'm going to give it an 8.
Good grief. Right, okay. I was thinking, clearly, you're not going to be actually looking at season one of Charlie's Angels to actually see more Farrah Fawcett qualities put to the fore. But anyway, so it goes. Next week, we will be going back in time to President Grant's era in the United States, post-American Civil War, not too long after the American Civil War, for the Secret Service adventures of James West and Artemis Gordon with Train, and we'll be exploring the joys of dynamic numerology and actually spending a night in the Circus of Death, written by Arthur Weingarten, our very own. Tessa, are you tempted to check out $6 Million Man, or is it a case of, no, I might go Wild Wild West, or don't be silly, it's up to you to tell me whether I should or not. Teach.
Yes. Well, Wild Wild West sounds good, but no, I think I trust your judgments. I think, you know, some of the scores were all right. So, no, I'm going to give it a go, I think. Definitely.
There we are. We might have feedback from that, and not, of course, the feedback that you get when you're going through complete silence and you have that re-entry challenge, which, again, wasn't it wonderful to see the USS Kitty Hawk and their staff kind of just cheering as they would? I mean, just think if they actually had to pay extras to actually get that group of people together. It's great stuff. I think even it's a lesson from the Irwin Allen book of how to use found footage effectively and actually make sure you can actually enhance the budget of the whole sequence just as a result of that. So there we have it. Again, the episode of $6 Million Man, music by Oliver Nelson, and, of course, produced by Harve Bennett, written by DC Fontana. That's it. That's a wrap. Keep on resonating. Thank you.